Well, let me begin by saying what a blessing it is to be here tonight, and good evening to all of you, and thank you to Sandy and the gang for the invitation to be here. And Sandy, thank you for that very detailed introduction. I almost feel guilty about that long list of things. Even I was tuning out. Imagine that if that was true, I apologize to the rest of you, but hopefully for those of you who are interested in such pedantic details of what I tend to do my research on, maybe that's interesting to you, but it's just really great to be with you. Thanks for coming out tonight. I know you have busy lives, and I hope this topic tonight is of interest to you. It's a real pleasure to be at Virginia Tech and even in Blacksburg. I've never been here before and just really enjoyed the drive up, beautiful scenery, a beautiful campus, and just a great place. I was even telling the gentleman at dinner that my son, John, it's not that long until he'll be thinking about where to go to college, and he really has sort of an engineer's mind. And I told him today as I left, I said, you know, I'll be up at Virginia Tech, and it's a great engineering school. And his eyes kind of lit up, and so who knows, I'll go back and tell him what I learned about all of you when I get back. Nonetheless, I'm excited to be here tonight, excited about this topic. Let me also say, as Sandy mentioned, I'm not just your visiting speaker tonight, but also president and professor of New Testament at Reformed Theological Seminary. I was surprised to note that it's only about a 2 hours and 45 minute drive from our school here to you. And as I thought about that, I wanted just to plant a seed in your head tonight. I imagine there's some here who've probably thought about going to the next level of their study of the Bible. Maybe you've thought about going deeper and further in theological exploration than you ever have. Maybe you thought about getting a graduate degree in biblical studies or heading into ministry. Or maybe some of you, even after tonight, are going to have that little idea sort of pricked in your brain. And if that's true for you, I just want to invite you to come up to me afterwards and introduce yourself. I'd love to meet you and tell you about what we do at RTS in Charlotte. It's a short distance away. Perhaps at some point you come and pay us a visit. We'd love to tell you more about what's going on at our campus down there. Now, let me turn our attention to our topic tonight. This is an interesting one. I trust everyone has an outline in front of you or around, and you can hijack the one from your neighbor if they've got an extra. But you can see at the very top, our topic tonight is the Bible's missing books, or another way to say, hidden gospels, our culture's quest to rewrite the story of Jesus. And to start our time out tonight, I actually want to begin by talking about Muhammad Ali for a moment. Now, I know as you hear that, you're thinking, why in the world would I go to a lecture about the Bible and we talk about the boxer Muhammad Ali? But actually, I don't want to talk about the boxer Muhammad Ali. I actually want to talk about the shepherd Muhammad Ali, who maybe made one of the most interesting and most amazing archaeological discoveries in the history of the modern world. In 1945, in the deserts outside of a little place called Nag Hammadi, Egypt, a shepherd by the name of Muhammad Ali and his brother Sharif Ali were digging in the ground next to this cliff for fertilizer, a certain kind of soil that could help their crops. And as they're digging, their shovel hits something hard. They think, what in the world have we struck? And they began to clear away the dirt and clear away the stones, and they began to realize that underneath their shovel was an earthenware jar. Now, at this point, they're pretty excited because they thought, well, maybe there's gold inside. Maybe there's some sort of treasure inside. So they end up scooting all the dirt away, and they recover this earthenware jar about this big, and they think, what should we do? And Muhammad Ali is about to break it open, hoping to find treasure, and his brother, Sharif Ali, says, don't break it open. Maybe there's a genie inside that's going to curse us. True story. Well, after back and forth debating here and there, they said, well, look, it's probably most important to find out what's inside. So they ended up breaking this jar. And they were grandly disappointed because they didn't find gold. They didn't find treasures. They didn't find jewels. They didn't find really much of anything they thought was valuable. In fact, all they found in there were books. Boring, old, dusty books they couldn't even read. In fact, they open up these books. It turns out later they would have known if they would have stuck with this. They found out later there was 52 tractate stories in this collection, in this little miniature library tucked away that go all the way back to the earliest centuries of Christianity. And they didn't know what to do with these books, so Muhammad Ali ended up selling them to some sort of antiquities dealer for not much money, and he didn't realize that what he gave away was what has become known today as the Gnostic Gospels. What he ended up giving away was 52 tractates over many different books of some of the most bizarre, strange, esoteric Christian writings we've ever seen. What he actually found was a whole collection of books of what we might call alternate Christianities, at the center of which is one of the most famous books outside the New Testament that has ever been discovered, known as the Gospel of Thomas. Now, if you would have told Muhammad Ali all this, he would not have sold it for a day's wages. He would have kept those books, and who knows how much they're worth today. Ever since that discovery in 1945, people have become enamored with hidden gospels. Lost gospels, gospels that no one knew about, that were discovered in the sands of Egypt, that make us ask a lot of very normal questions. Questions about the Gospel of Thomas that no doubt you have always wondered and maybe even are asking tonight, which is, well, what do we do with a book like Thomas? Did Thomas really write this book, a follower of Jesus? Is this a gospel? Is it like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? And if we believe Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John tell us things about Jesus, maybe Thomas can tell us things about Jesus. Moreover, you might be asking, why is it that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John have this privileged status in Christian circles today, but not the Gospel of Thomas? What if the Gospel of Thomas actually gets Jesus right? What if it's the version of Christianity contained in the Gnostic Gospels that's actually the true version of Christianity, and the Christianity that you and I read in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is just the false version of Christianity? Why not that Gospel instead of the Gospels we have? Now, if you're a person that asks questions like that, you're not alone. First of all, college students and people all over the world ask that question. But you know who else is asking that question? Scholars are asking that question. And ever since the discovery of the Gospel of Thomas by Muhammad Ali in 1945, scholars have had a very common refrain over the last 50 or 60 years, and it's simply this. The discovery of the Gospel of Thomas means there's nothing special at all about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Discovery of the Gospel of Thomas, and many other Gospels we'll talk about tonight, means that what you read in your Bibles is just one of many presentations of Jesus, not necessarily the right one, not necessarily accurate at all, and you can just basically go and pick another Gospel if it suits your fancy. So the question before us tonight is that line of thinking accurate? There's no doubt that the Gospel of Thomas and many other Gospels exist. That's not in doubt. That's obvious. We found these Gospels. The question is, are they as authentic, are they as legitimate, are they as historically reliable as the Gospels we find in our Bibles, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? And that is a very important question for us to answer. It's certainly an important question for you to answer if you consider yourself a Christian. I imagine many of you have shown up tonight, you probably do consider yourself a Christian. If you do, you read your Bibles, and you've no doubt read the Gospels, and you believe they portray Jesus, but then you have a university religion class where your professor tells you, no, you can't trust these at all, so you have the question, well, what am I going to do with that? Then others of you tonight may be showing up here, and you may not be a Christian at all. You may be an atheist or agnostic, may not know what you believe, but you realize the person of Jesus seems to be a pretty important person in the history of the world, and maybe I need to figure out which book really tells me what he's really like. And so all of us have a vested interest in getting to the bottom of this question of which gospel should we follow and which gospels should we not. So here's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to explore that question, maybe at a level of detail you've never had a chance to explore before. I'm going to start first, in just a moment, by giving you a little bit of background and how we got here. In other words, what in the world makes people so fascinated with these diverse gospels anyway? And then I'm going to walk you through what I consider four good reasons why Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John really are the gospels that should have made it into the New Testament. To put it yet another way, one of the things I want to show you tonight is that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John made it into our New Testaments for a very good reason. You may not know the reasons, but I'm going to tell you at least four of the reasons tonight, and that's what we're going to take with our time. And then when we're done with all that, hopefully you'll have a chance to ask your questions. We'll open up for some Q&A time. And so if there's something I say you want to follow up on, or maybe you've got your Bible question you've been holding in the tank for a while, and you're like, finally, I got my shot, right? And so you can line up on one of these microphones and share your question tonight. But if you look down at your outline tonight, I want to direct our attention to the very first question there, the background question, our culture's fascination with lost gospels. Here's what I want to start with tonight, and that is this question. Why is it that you and I and everyone in our culture are so enamored with a discovery like the Gospel of Thomas? You notice that about every Easter and every Christmas, some major news magazine or website puts out some sort of article or some sort of piece that talks about whether the Gospels are really reliable, whether Jesus really rose from the dead, or whether he was really born in a manger, or what have you. This, our culture is fascinated with rewriting the story of Jesus. Why is that? I want to suggest to you that there's a word that stands out, at least in my mind, as I think about this on an academic level. Our culture is fascinated with this word. They love this word, and the discovery of the Gospel of Thomas just feeds this word. And that one word that our culture is fascinated by is the word diversity. Now, when I use the word diversity here, I'm not talking about ethnic diversity. That's a whole other conversation. I'm talking not about ethnic diversity. I'm talking about religious diversity, philosophical diversity, intellectual diversity. In fact, here on a college campus like Virginia Tech, no doubt sort of the refrain you hear all the time is that, wow, look at all the different views out there in the world. Look at all the different ideas, all the different philosophical takes on reality and metaphysics, all the different religious systems. All these different views, people love to talk about them and applaud them and think about them and explore them and lay them all out on the table. And people are fascinated with the issue of diversity. But you know what's interesting about diversity is it's not just something that's a fact, and it is, by the way. Diverse views in the world, philosophically and religiously, there's no doubt those exist. They're all over the place. That's not what's interesting. What's interesting is the conclusion drawn from that fact. What do we conclude in light of diversity? And here's what our culture tells us. Because there are so many different philosophical, intellectual, and religious views, because that diversity exists, therefore, none of them, and certainly not one of them, could ever be right or could ever be the one true view. To put it yet another way, what our culture tells us under the heading of diversity is because there's a multiplicity of options, no one option could possibly be the option. The mere existence of diversity leads people to conclude that there could be no one right way. Now, leaving aside the philosophical coherence of that idea, and by the way, that concept has all kinds of philosophical problems, what you find is with that idea in mind, suddenly you discover something like the Gospel of Thomas, or the Gospel of Peter, or the Gospel of Philip, or the Gospel of Truth, or the Gospel of Mary, or the Gospel of Judas. And we could go on and on. And you know what people say? Ah, look, this feeds exactly what we think should be true of the world. Look at all these different Gospels. Therefore, not one of them could possibly be any better than another. Now, if you're wondering where that idea came from, in the history of gospel studies, I'm going to give you a name you probably have never heard before. And that is the name Walter Bauer. And as we're walking through our little study there, if you're tracking, I'm under number one, point B. The study of early Christianity has been affected by this push for diversity, and Walter Bauer is really the reason why. You probably never heard of Walter Bauer. He wrote a very famous book in 1934 in Germany. It was called Orthodoxy and Heresy in Earliest Christianity. Now, in 1934 in Germany, no one was thinking about Walter Bauer. In 1934 in Germany, everyone was thinking about Adolf Hitler, who had just become the head of the German nation and the Führer, and everything from there, we all know historically, took a very dark path. But here, behind the scenes, what no one really noticed, Walter Bauer wrote this book, Orthodoxy and Heresy in Earliest Christianity, and it languished in obscurity for 40 years. And it wasn't really until 1971 that it was translated into English, and people began to read it in the English-speaking world, and they realized, wow, this is an amazing idea. And here's what Walter Bauer said. He said that when you look at early Christianity, there's no such thing as early Christianity. In fact, what he says, when you look at early Christianity, what you find is early Christianities, plural. Bauer argued in his very famous book that early Christianity was very diverse. No one agreed on anything, according to Bauer. No one could get along. No one could agree on who Jesus was. No one could agree on what he did. No one could agree on how you got saved. No one could agree on what books were in the Bible. No one could agree on what God was like. No one could agree on the doctrine of creation. No one could agree on much of anything, according to Bauer. And so what you have in Christianity is this battle, this war amongst various Christian factions, all claiming to be the real Christianity, and all claiming that everybody else is wrong, and they're all fighting it out. But according to Bauer, one side won. And the side that won those theological battles, that side picked Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as their gospels. What if, said Bauer, another side had won? It's an interesting question, isn't it? And Bauer says, look, there's all these competing Christianities. What if the version of Christianity that you think's Christianity didn't win? What if the Gnostics won? What books would you be reading today in your Bibles? Not Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You'd be reading the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Judas, Ptolemy's letter to Flora, and a whole bunch of other books in the ancient world. So Bauer's argument was an argument based on diversity. He said, look, because there's all these different views, no one gospel is right. You can have whatever version of Christianity you want. That has been very influential on modern scholarship. If you're taking classes here at Virginia Tech and you take a New Testament introduction class, chances are you're hearing Walter Bauer's ideas, even if they don't mention his name. If you're hearing people talk about alternate gospels and how one gospel is no better than another, you're hearing Walter Bauer's ideas without realizing his name. And the payoff here is huge on a religious level. Why do people find that attractive? Why is it when they hear Walter Bauer's ideas, they find that intriguing? Leave aside the historical merits of it for a moment. I'm going to spend the rest of our time together talking about the historical merits of it. But just think for a moment. Why do people like the idea of this multiplicity of gospels where none is more authentic than the other? And the answer, I think we all know, is simply this, that people like to pick the Jesus that suits their fancy. If, in fact, no gospel is better than another, then you can just look at the gospels laying around out there and just pick the gospel you happen to prefer. And believe me, they're very different, as we'll see. The Gnostic gospels present Jesus in one way. The gospel of Peter presents Jesus in another way. The gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John present Jesus in yet another way. And so why this is attractive to people, the reason people can't stop talking about the gospel of Thomas, the reason it is enamored both scholar and lay people alike, because people love to have choice. And they love to have choice in terms of what they believe, and they love to believe that whatever choice they make is equally valid historically and religiously. At the bottom of that first Roman numeral, I've listed out several examples of these other gospels I've already mentioned, but the payoff here is very obvious, and that is, if in fact these other gospels exist, and if in fact they're equally viable, then you can pick whatever Jesus you happen to prefer. Now, what I've just laid out for you is just the standard story you're going to hear in a university, in a news magazine, on the internet, and beyond. What I want to do with the rest of our time is ask whether that actually works historically. Is it really true that you could take all the Gospels and toss them up in the air, and they would just all flutter down, spread out equally with no distinction at all? It's just a free-for-all, intellectually. What I want to suggest to you is that not only is that not accurate, that's grossly inaccurate. In fact, it doesn't take a lot of poking around in the historical details. And what I'm getting ready to tell you tonight is nothing complicated. What I'm getting ready to tell you tonight is actually nothing new. But what I'm getting ready to tell you tonight is the very simple, basic reason why Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John really do belong in our gospel, in our New Testament, and not other gospels. So I'm going to walk you through 4 points. Now, as we get into these, I want you to think of these sort of like talking points to some extent, or you could think of them as a framework for how to think. And the next time you're talking to your non-Christian friend, and they're like, hey, what's so special about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? My hope is that you can at least pluck one of the four. It would be great if it was all four. I've taught long enough to know that never happens, right? I have no illusion to think anyone's going to leave here tonight and remember all four. I won't remember all four after tonight, right? So I don't expect you to remember. I can't remember what I said the day before either. But maybe one or two will stick in your mind, and you'll remember, hey, I have just a basic thought on why Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John really do make a lot of sense. Now, as we go through these four, not only are they basic, but don't be under the illusion this is exhaustive. There's so much more that can be said here. I'm trying to give you, within 45 minutes, some broad sort of framework of things, okay? But in the Q&A time, we can maybe go deeper and further into some of these issues as those conversations lead us. So let's just walk through these four things one at a time. So we're in Roman numeral 2 here, if you're tracking in your outline. Let's start with point A there, the very first of the four, and it's very simple. Why are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John distinctive? First answer, because they're the earliest gospels we have. I want you to think for a moment with me about what you would prefer to have if you could pick a gospel. Let's think about it like that for a moment. Rather than thinking about the gospels we actually have, let's imagine that you would be able to say, here's the kind of gospel I would like to have, the kind of gospel that has a reasonable shot of telling me something accurate about the historical Jesus. What kind of gospel would that be? Interesting, this first point captures that, and that is that you'd want a gospel dated sometime during the first century. Why? Because Jesus actually lived during the first century, right? And his immediate followers, his eyewitnesses, actually lived during the first century. To put it yet another way, if you wanted a gospel that was reliable, you'd want a gospel that goes further, deeper, closer to the events it purports to describe than any other gospel you could get your hands on. Imagine for a moment that you had a gospel that was written in, say, the 4th century. By the way, we have gospels written in the 4th century. And they're very bizarre, I might add, but we have them. And we have gospels written in the 3rd century. And as we'll see tonight, we have gospels written in the 2nd century. But let's imagine you took a 4th century gospel and said, I'm going to go with this one. Well, obviously it presents a little bit of a problem for you. Whoever wrote that 4th century gospel is 3 or 4 centuries away from any of the events it purports to record. And just on a basic historical rule of thumb, don't you want to get as close, as far back to the events you're purporting to record as you possibly can? The answer to that is absolutely yes. And here's the stunning fact. Only Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John are dated to the 1st century of all the gospels in existence today. They're the only ones that get us back to the 1st century, and they, therefore, the earliest gospels we possess. Now, I'll make a note there in your outline here that all the canonical gospels are dated somewhere between 50 and 90 A.D. Now, if we had time, we could parse all this out, and I could talk about why we date the gospels the way we date them, and I could talk about what the different dates are and what the range scholars have. We're not going to go all into that tonight, but here's a stunning fact for you tonight, and that is that scholars are actually fairly unanimous on this point. It's pretty rare to get a consensus in my field, I can tell you that. I can't think of hardly anything that biblical scholars agree on. And we didn't fight about it all. And what's incredible is you look at the consensus of modern scholars, you take even the most hypercritical scholar like Bart Ehrman, and you take even the most conservative scholar out there you can find, and you know what's remarkable? They all agree that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are dated to the 1st century, and they all pretty much agree that no other gospels are. This is a stunning fact. Now, to be sure, every once in a while, you have a scholar that gets his guts up and says, look, I'm going to give it a go again, and I'm going to try to date Gospel of Thomas of the 1st century. And you can trace this. Every once in a while, a scholar gets enough courage to write a book on this and give it a go. And every time, it fails. Time and time again. You have fringe scholars, to be sure, yes. You can go Google this later on the internet and find some scholar somewhere that wants to date one of these fringe Gospels of the 1st century. But I can tell you this. The consensus of modern scholarship is absolutely clear. Only Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John get you to the 1st century. Only they go as far back as we can get. So if you're going to pick a gospel that takes you as far back as you can get, wouldn't you pick the earliest ones you can find? Here's another interesting little tidbit on this point. Number two there. Because it's only Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that are dated to the 1st century, it's interesting to know that no apocryphal gospel is dated to the 1st century. I already said this a little bit when I talked about Thomas, but you have to realize that it doesn't stop with Thomas, whether it's Peter or Mary or Philip or the Gospel of Truth or Papyrus Edgerton II or all these other Gospels like the Gospel of Judas. None of those are dated to the 1st century, and everyone agrees. That means none of them could have been written by anybody who actually knew Jesus. What are the implications of this first point? Such a basic first point. I just want you to think about how simple this is. When I said I'm not really giving anything new tonight, actually, this is a very simple point that almost everyone agrees on. But let me draw out two implications. You can see it there at the bottom of your first page there. And I already drew out the first one. Closer to the events of Jesus, the better. This is an historical rule of thumb, by the way, that affects any historical writing we look at in the ancient world. Whenever we look at a historical account in the ancient world, we ask, well, who wrote this? And could they have actually known anything about what they were writing about? It's a pretty good question to ask, isn't it? Which is why if you picked up a gospel that's from the 4th century and said, I'm going to go with this one, you have a real credibility problem there because the person you're hearing from doesn't have any real reason to think he would know anything about the historical Jesus that lived 3 centuries before him. The gospels were not in that condition when it comes to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But there's a second implication. Notice at the very bottom of the page here, and this is something that most people overlook. If Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were written in the 1st century, then they were written when eyewitnesses were still alive when the gospels were published, and thus could challenge their content. I haven't even gotten to the question of who wrote the Gospels yet. I've only gotten to the question of when they were written, and they've been written in the 1st century. Aside from who wrote them, we're going to get to that in a second. I want you to realize this other implication of that. It's simply this. They were written at a time when someone could contest whether what those Gospels said really happened, because there's people around that saw those things. If you, in your Gospel, said that Pontius Pilate was the person who declared the death sentence on Jesus, and someone was there and it wasn't Pontius Pilate, you've got a historical credibility problem in your gospel. If you talk about the crucifixion events, which were very public, which people could see, and it didn't happen that way, you have a lot of credibility problems in your gospel. Now, you may be thinking in the back of your mind that no one in the ancient world did this. In the ancient world, everyone just wrote history books, and no one thought about it, and no one critiqued each other's history books, and therefore you could have gotten away with it. You could have gotten away with writing a history book that was lousy and inaccurate when there's other eyewitnesses still alive, and it wouldn't have mattered, right? Wrong. Actually, in the ancient world, we have all kinds of evidence of historians critiquing each other's histories. Herodotus, Thucydides, others who write about their other histories and say, hey, that history's not very good. You didn't interview any eyewitnesses. You weren't there. What's interesting is to try to write a gospel that's grossly inaccurate and write it when there's eyewitnesses around that could contradict, either affirm or deny what you said, that would never get off the ground. And what you realize then is that the timing of these gospels makes all the difference in the world. Go back to my earlier point about the 4th century gospel. If you wrote in the 4th century, is anyone around who could say it didn't happen that way? No, you can just say, it's the story I wrote. And someone goes, well, I wasn't there either. No one knows. Which is why you want a gospel in the 1st century. Now, on one level, we could stop here tonight. I could give you a one-point outline. Wouldn't you love that? You have to go back to your professors at Virginia Tech and say, I like these one-point outlines. Got one thing to remember. That's all you need. Once you know that, the discussion's to some extent already over. But let's move on. There's more to be said here. Flip your notes over. Let's look at the second reason tonight why Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are unique. And that is point B, the canonical gospels have a credible connection to the apostles. I'm going to go back to my question earlier. If you were to try to describe the ideal gospel, what would it look like? The first thing is you'd want a gospel that gets you as close to the events as possible. That's point A. That's an issue of when. But now the second thing you'd want if you were crafting your own gospel is you'd want a gospel written by someone who was actually there, or at least was friends with someone who was actually there. In other words, you want a gospel that contained eyewitness testimony. So the first point is the when. The second point is the who. Who would you want your gospel written by? Well, the answer is obviously someone who knows something about what they're saying, who actually witnessed these things, who are eyewitnesses. And here's where you come to the issue of the apostles. Now, one of the questions I asked there in your notes is, well, what in the world is an apostle? I trust that most of you probably know, but the apostles in the ancient world were Jesus' closest friends, in essence. They were his companions. They were his students. They lived with him. They learned from him. They traveled with him. They witnessed the things he did. They witnessed the things he said. We have good reasons historically to think they recorded the things he said. We'll come back to that at a later point. But they were in the mix fully in Jesus' life, so much so that for 3 years they were his companions by his side during all the things the Gospels purport to record. But there's more than that. The apostles weren't simply the people who could have known. They were also the people that Jesus commissioned to speak for him. Now think about it for a moment. There's probably a lot of people in the ancient world that said, I can speak for Jesus. There's a lot of people in the modern world that would say, I can speak for Jesus. But you know something? Jesus didn't pick just anybody to speak for him. We have good historical reasons to think this band of disciples around Jesus were the ones that not only knew about these things, but that Jesus sent out to speak about these things. Now, I don't know about you, but if I wanted to get a gospel that was reliable, I wouldn't want to pick one that just was early. We've already got that. I'd want to pick one that also could have been written by one of them. Wouldn't you want a gospel at least has a shot of being written by an apostle? At least a shot. And here's the amazing thing about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is that we have more than a shot. We have actually very good reasons to think Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are actually written by apostles or, in the case of Mark and Luke, people who were direct companions of apostles. So look at point one in your outline there. We have good reasons to connect the canonical gospels to the apostles. Now, this is its own lecture. You're thinking, how is he going to say much about this? And I don't have time to give all the case of why we think the apostles are the authors of the Gospels that we're talking about here, but I'm just going to give you a couple little snippets to have an idea of why we think this. One of the best ways we can know about the authorship of these Gospels is what people were saying about the authorship of these Gospels as far back as we can get. In other words, testimony from the early church fathers about what they knew about who wrote these Gospels is very good historical evidence. And here's the thing I want you to realize. In the second century, we have a guy by the name of Irenaeus, who's a very famous bishop in the second century. And without going into all the details, Irenaeus tells us about who wrote the Gospels. And in the case of John, which I want to hone in on here for a second, he tells us very plainly that John, the Gospel that bears the name of John, was written by the son of Zebedee, John, in the Gospels, a disciple of Jesus. Very plain testimony from Irenaeus. Now, by the way, the second century is not that far off the first century. In historical reckoning, that's pretty close, but let's just ask the question, do we have any reason to trust Irenaeus when he says that? I mean, someone could arguably say, well, look, Irenaeus was just making it up. Irenaeus was just a shot in the dark. Irenaeus was just saying what he wanted to be the author of John, not who he really thought was the author of John. You can go down that route, but you know what? Historically, that is very implausible, and here's why. Irenaeus got his information about all these things from a person by the name of Polycarp, who's one of the earliest bishops in the church. You know who Polycarp's mentor was? The Apostle John. So I want you to think about this with me for a moment. John himself mentors Polycarp, and Polycarp mentors Irenaeus. And Irenaeus tells everyone that John wrote John. Now, what's the chances that Irenaeus just blew it? I mean, you can suggest that. You have the freedom historically to say, yeah, I'm convinced he blew it. But you have to have good reasons for that. Historically speaking, we know that Irenaeus got a lot of information from Polycarp. If anybody had a good reason to know, Polycarp knew John himself. You're talking about being one person removed from John. Irenaeus didn't know John, but Irenaeus knew Polycarp, who was mentored by John. How do you get better than that on historical connectivity? You have to have a good reason to doubt that. Now, let me add another layer on top of that. That's not even in your notes, but I mention it here, and that is the early nature of the titles of these Gospels. On a manuscript level, I want you to realize this fact, which is interesting. As far back as we can go in our early Gospel manuscripts, as soon as we can see titles on them, as far back as we go, the titles are always just like we have now, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In other words, there's no variety of titles. It's not like the further back you go, you got some other guy in the mix, right? You know, the Gospel according to David or the Gospel according to someone else. No, they're not around. What you have is a uniformity of titles as far back as you can go. And here's another thing. You have no example of a Gospel anywhere that's anonymous without a title. As far back as we can go, we see titles, and as far back as we can see the titles, it's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. How do you get that kind of unanimity? You can't get that kind of unanimity by somebody in a smoke-filled room thinking, you know what? We got all these Gospels without titles, and let's all make up some titles. And what do you like? You like the name John? Great. How about Luke? That sounds good. Let's just slap these names on here and send them out and get uniformity across the entire Greco-Roman world in one fell swoop. It doesn't happen that way historically. What I want you to realize is that we have very good reasons to think that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were written by the names they bear. Now, what's the implication of that? Look what I've said there in your notes. That means the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, contain not only eyewitness testimony, that's pretty important, but authoritative eyewitness testimony. What I mean by authoritative is that these were Jesus' spokesmen. Don't forget, there were other eyewitnesses that would have seen some of these things. But not all eyewitnesses were commissioned by Jesus to speak for him. And so you have the absolute most desirable thing in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. If you're going to create a gospel, you would want this. At least something that has a shot of being written by the people who are actually there. Now, once you lay that out, what about the apocryphal gospels? What about all these other gospels that we know about in the ancient world? What about them? Could they have been written by apostles? Well, we already know that they were all second century or later. We already talked about that in the first point. And if they're all written in the second century or later, what's the shot that they have a chance to be written by an apostle? I'll give you a percentage, and it's this. Zero. They have no shot of being written by apostles. Now, people get hung up on all this all the time. They're like, well, hold on, but they have the names of apostles associated with them. It's called the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Peter. Yeah, they do. And if you were trying to write a gospel in the second century or later, and you were trying to get it to get a following, and you're trying to get someone's attention, and you wanted to give it a name that could really get it somewhere, what would you call it? You wouldn't call it Bob's Gospel, right? You would call it Peter's Gospel, right? Or the Gospel of Philip, or the Gospel of Thomas. In fact, in the ancient world, you know what's interesting? You can see that what the apocryphal Gospels are doing, that's the name for these other Gospels, what the apocryphal Gospels are doing, they're actually mimicking and copying what's already true of the canonical ones. In other words, they're actually following suit. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, those have names. Let's try to come up with our own credible name. We'll pick some other apostles whose names haven't been used yet. We can see this unfolding historically. In fact, there's even a gospel that's called the Gospel of the Twelve. In other words, someone goes, well, I got a gospel written by all of them, right? I can trump all of you. Okay, I got all 12 of them writing a gospel. Now, what does that tell you? That tells you that, yeah, of course these Gospels are being written late. And of course you'd stick a name on them to try to give them credibility. But if they're late, and we know they're late for all kinds of reasons, then they could not have been written by the names attached to them. So I go back to my prior point. There's only one set of Gospels that has a shot of being written by someone who's actually there. And they are none other than Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Let's look at the third bullet point. We've talked about the when, and we've talked about the who. Now we talk about the what. What are these Gospels like? Here's the third reason why the canonical Gospels are unique, and that is they lack the legendary embellishments of later Gospels. Here's the thing that is probably pretty interesting for you to know, is that when you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and then you read these other Gospels, you quickly, without even being a scholar, realize there's something very different going on here. These Gospels sound very different. They have a very different feel to them. I don't know if you ever realized it before, but have you ever noticed how measured, how calm, how sort of non-embellished, if you will, the canonical Gospels are in the way they tell their stories? Now, most of this hasn't dawned on us because in our modern world, we're so hung up on miracles that we think if you tell a miracle, you're already off the grid, okay? Now, I get that. I realize that some of you tonight might be skeptical of miracles. You think, look, if the book's got a miracle in it, I'm done. That's it, right? But you need to think bigger than that in the ancient world. You need to think a lot different about how these Gospels are written. The issue isn't just whether they record miracles. The issue is the way they record miracles. Notice how I put it here is that the canonical Gospels speak in a restrained, matter-of-fact manner. And let me give you an example of what I mean by this in case you're still unclear. I want you to think about the resurrection for a moment, which the four Gospels tell us about. You ever notice that the Gospels don't actually describe the resurrection happening? You ever notice that before? It's a pretty obvious point, isn't it? Some of you are probably in your minds thinking, golly, I've never thought of that. What do you get when you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? You get the followers of Jesus showing up to the resurrection after it's already happened. The stone's rolled back, Jesus is gone, things are unfolding, there's no body, the resurrection's already taken place. There is no one who saw it. There is no gospel account that shows it happening. Now, just thinking about that for a moment, if you wanted to write your gospel and you wanted it to sound like a zinger and you wanted to get people's attention and you wanted to prove to them that Jesus rose from the dead, wouldn't you actually describe it happening? It's actually remarkably restrained. It almost sounds like it might have been written by an eyewitness who showed up at the tomb when the stone was actually rolled away. I'll give you another example of what I mean by restrained. And that is Jesus as a child. Ever wonder what Jesus was like as a kid? Now, surely, if you have an imagination, this has crossed your mind, right? I mean, we only have one account in the Gospels. It's even barely mentions Jesus as a boy. Of course, we have that story in Luke, and he's not really a child anymore. He's 12 or whatever, 11, whatever happens to be. He's in the temple, and he's impressive at a young age, to be sure, but he's not a little kid. And you wonder, what would it be like to grow up with Jesus? You know, Jesus had a lot of brothers and sisters. We know that from the accounts. You ever wonder what his brothers and sisters thought about Jesus? How many times did they hear, why can't you be more like your brother Jesus, right? We all wonder, did Jesus ever get spanked? Did he ever get grounded? What was he like? Now, it doesn't take more than 30 seconds of thinking about the life of Jesus before you ask that question. Now, let's just back up for a second. If you're going to write a gospel, are you really going to write gospels and not mention hardly anything about it? Nothing? All four gospels? That's remarkably restrained. Now, let me suggest to you that when we get to the apocryphal gospels, we find a whole different world here. And here's the reason most people don't see that whole different world, because they've never actually read them. So I want to do a little poll here, a little straw poll. I want you to be honest, okay, about what you've read. I want to know how many in here have actually read, not heard of, not answered to the quiz on your exam, actually have read the Gospel of Peter. Three, maybe, hands? Okay, I'll ask a second question. How many here have read, not just heard of, the infancy, not the Gospel of Thomas, but the infancy Gospel of Thomas? Maybe a little more there, four. Now, those two Gospels I just laid out for you are not obscure in the scholarly world. In fact, on the contrary, those Gospels are very well known. But you know what? The average person has never read them. This room is a fairly fair example of what average people read. And truthfully, as a side note, I'm kind of glad you hadn't read them, just as an additional note, right? I'm sure if you're in a church, your pastors are probably glad that you're not reading the Gospel of Peter on Sunday morning. But here's the interesting thing. When you read books like that, here's what you find. You find the gaps in the canonical Gospels filled in. This is an incredibly interesting observation that scholars have made for generations. You can tell a Gospel is late. You could tell a gospel is a reaction when you realize it's actually filling in the gaps left by a prior book. And you know what Mark's apocryphal gospels often is? They do exactly that. I'm going to give you a couple examples here. You see them in your notes. The first is the infancy gospel of Thomas. The infancy gospel of Thomas is that gospel you've always been wondering about that tells the story of Jesus as a child. But in case you always wonder what Jesus was like as a child, he's not going to be like this in your head. Because the infancy gospel of Thomas, Jesus is a rather frightening, scary little kid. He's less like the Son of God and more like sort of Damien from The Omen, really, in this infancy gospel. Jesus bumps into a little kid that makes him mad, and he kills him on the spot in the infancy gospel of Thomas. And then when the town folks are mad about it, he raises him from the dead. In another instance, Jesus is breaking the Sabbath day by making clay pigeons out of mud. And they come to confront him about him breaking of the Sabbath day, and Jesus changes the clay pigeons into real pigeons, and the evidence flies away. You have this little hellion, in a sense, in the Gospel of Thomas. Running around, you can see that whoever wrote the infancy Gospel of Thomas felt like, I've got to portray Jesus as the Son of God from the very get-go. And so he's zapping people, killing people, raising people from the dead, doing miracles from the very get-go. And you read this thing, you think, this is weird. This is bizarre. This doesn't sound at all like the restrained matter-of-fact manner or writing that the Gospels present. And most importantly in all of that, it's presenting a fill-in of the gaps left by the canonical Gospels. Let me give you another example. Gospel of Peter, as you can see there in your notes. Most of you probably haven't read that either based on the straw poll I just took. The Gospel of Peter fills in another gap. You know what the Gospel of Peter does? It actually shows you the resurrection happening. In case you want to know, don't look it up on your phone, by the way. But when you get home tonight, you can Google the Gospel of Peter and you can read about it. But here's what happens in the Gospel of Peter. It gives you a front row seat. And what you've always wanted to see, Jesus coming out of the tomb. Wouldn't that just be a zinger? And I suppose if you're making up a gospel, you would include it. And you have it included in this made-up gospel. And here's what you see in the Gospel of Peter, and this gets bizarre too. Here the stone is rolled away in the Gospel of Peter, and out comes Jesus. But this is no normal Jesus. This isn't the Jesus of the canonical gospels at all. In fact, this is a spirit tower-high, 60-foot-tall Jesus that comes out of the tomb. He's not a Jesus who's a normal man. He's a Jesus who's a spirit creature who comes out, whose head touches the clouds. He's giant Jesus. He says, I tell my students, he's Godzilla Jesus. He's big. He's tall. He comes out of the tomb. You're like, what in the world is this? He's not even a physical body Jesus. And there's reasons for that behind the Gospel of Peter I won't get into theologically, why they have a disembodied 60-foot-tall Jesus marching out of the tomb. But even if that's strange, it gets stranger. Following Jesus out of the tomb, the text is very clear, following out of the tomb, moving along, is the cross itself. Now, I don't know how the cross got in the tomb, and I certainly don't know what it means when it says you follow Jesus out of the tomb. But presumably, there's a floating cross following the 60-foot Jesus leaving the tomb. And then it gets even more weird, because the cross starts to talk, and it starts to speak. So you've got a 60-foot-tall floating Jesus who's followed by a cross that starts talking. Now, you read all that, and you can say, gee, this is just as authentic as the canonical four. You can say that, but you have to realize that one of the reasons that the early church, in everyone's sense in the history of the church, and even many modern scholars, look at those gospels and say, you know something, those may be curious, those may be entertaining, they may be interesting and fascinating. But that's not the same thing as saying that they're equally valid at telling us who the real Jesus actually is. Now that leads to the fourth and final of my 4 points here. And this, I think, is the icing on the proverbial cake. We've seen when the Gospels are written, they're the earliest. We've seen who wrote them. This is the only ones we have a shot at getting written by an eyewitness. Thirdly, they're very different than the apocryphal Gospels we see. And then fourthly, the canonical Gospels were recognized as authoritative from a very early date. And here's what I mean by this. You could ask the question simply this way. When you look at the very earliest followers of Jesus that we can get records of, which Gospels did they think were the most authentic? How far back can you see early Christians recognizing that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the right ones? And here's the thing that's amazing that you're getting told out in the world today. If you just read it on the internet or read books like The Da Vinci Code or whatever, here's what you're going to hear from people, is that no one knew what Gospels to read in the early church. And it was a general free-for-all, and everyone was reading the Gospel of their choice. And it wasn't really until the 4th century Council of Nicaea that someone got together, probably again in a smoke-filled room, and decided, we're going to pick Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and we're going to force those on everyone else and burn their copies and then make our copies the right ones. And that's how Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John got chosen, right? And before that, no one knew what to read. That makes for a good story. And truthfully, for people who are sort of conspiracy theorist-minded, that's a great story, right? Because what do conspiracy theorists always want? They like to think that the status quo is all wrong, and there's some backstory to it, and there's something that really got messed up in the history of it, and then they're going to discover the real truth. The sad truth here is it's actually rather boring, okay? When you look at the history of the canonical Gospels, it wasn't all that drama. There wasn't all these councils and smoke-filled rooms. There was never a vote about the Gospels where they got barely in by one vote and Thomas got barely out and these apocryphal stories you're hearing. None of that happened. Here's what did happen. The earliest we can look in the historical record, as far back as we can see, you know what Gospels were being read? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I'll give you a few examples. You can see that in your notes there. And these are all second century examples, very early. Irenaeus, he was so sure about the four Gospels, he said there's four and only four. And anybody says otherwise, this isn't making any sense. I mean, it's like the four directions of the world. It's like the four creatures around the throne in Revelation. There's four Gospels. What's wrong with you people, right? That's Irenaeus. Moratorian Fragment, our earliest canonical list, four and only four. Clement of Alexandria, again, four and only four. We could go on and on here. Here's the interesting thing, is that as far back as we can see, it's just been these four. And here's what I want you to realize. It's kind of stunning for some people, and maybe it would be for you. There was never any real controversy about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Ever. Now, people think, oh, but I thought it was this big fight. Didn't Walter Bauer say it was a big war, and no one got along, and no one could agree? That's simply not true. Actually, historically speaking, this was hardly ever a debate. Now, some canonical books were debated. And if you're interested in going down that path, and I've written a couple books on the canon, and you can go and read, and I talk about those books. What's interesting is that they were very few who were of any meaningful debate. And they're very small, books like 2 John, 3 John, Jude, things like that, but not the Gospels. The earliest we can look, the farther back we can go, is just these four. Now, what about the apocryphal Gospels? Were they being read a lot? Were they really popular? Here's the thing that's amazing is that scholars will tell you that, oh, Thomas was popular, and the Gospel of Peter was popular, and these were just as popular as the canonical four. That is patently false. I'm going to give you a couple little stats here at the end that tell you this, which I think is interesting. First, not a single manuscript. And by the way, when we find Gospels, we find them in handwritten papyri or parchment manuscript. Not a single manuscript we have includes both apocryphal and canonical Gospels in the same manuscript. This is a stunning fact. Do you know that we have all kinds of manuscripts that include Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? These are called fourfold gospel manuscripts. But you know, we never find, not even once, a manuscript that says Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and Thomas. Ever. It's a stunning fact. Second fact, not a single canonical list includes both apocryphal and canonical gospels. We have a lot of early lists from the church. We could talk about where we get these and who makes them. These canonical lists tell us all the books that belong in the canon. We don't have a single list anywhere that has the four gospels with any apocryphal gospel mixed in. We don't have Matthew, Luke, Peter, and John. Doesn't happen. Every time we see those lists, guess what it is? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And then the last one, which I think is particularly fascinating because this is my field, we have hardly any manuscripts of these apocryphal gospels compared to the canonical ones. And let me explain what I mean by this. One of the ways we can know which books were popular in the ancient world, one of the ways we can know which books were being read in the ancient world and were the hot books, is by the fragments they leave behind. In other words, when we find a lot of fragments left behind of a certain book, we know that book got copied a lot. We know they got read a lot. We know it got used a lot. And so we know it was popular. Now, when it comes to the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we have these in droves in the early church. Tons of them. In fact, we have more copies of just John than any other apocryphal book. In fact, most apocryphal books combined. It's a stunning fact. In early Christianity, in just the first few centuries, we have well over 60 copies of the canonical Gospels. It's interesting. Do you know how many copies we have of the Gospel of Thomas in these early centuries? The answer is 3. That's it. And if you start adding up the Gospels from all the generations, we have thousands and thousands and thousands of them. And the Gospel of Thomas has just 3. And do you know that the Gospel of Mary, which people talk about, do you know the church father never even mentioned the Gospel of Mary? We didn't even know it existed. It was so unpopular until we found a copy of it in the sand. The Gospel of Thomas never is talked about by the church fathers except to condemn it. And it's barely mentioned. I'm telling you, it's not even close. If it was a popularity contest in the ancient world, this would be a runaway for the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Where does that leave us as we draw this to a close? Well, I think these are just four good reasons that you can take away to think that, you know something? Maybe when the early church settled on Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, maybe they got it right. You know, maybe these Gospels have been in the Bibles for thousands of years for a reason. Because just when you look at the historical facts, you find out it's really not even close. Now, this has implications for all of us because I want to take us back to where we started at the beginning of our lecture tonight. We all have a vested interest in the question, who is Jesus? Whether you're a Christian tonight and you already believe in Jesus, or you're an atheist and you don't believe in anything in the supernatural world, we all would agree that Jesus is one of the most significant figures in the history of the world, and getting him right is very, very important. I just want to encourage you tonight, whatever you think about Jesus, to investigate him, to explore what he said about himself, about his teachings, and about his own mission to save sinners for himself. I want you to explore all that. And the question is, where are you going to go to do that? You can go to Thomas, you can go to Peter, you can go to the Gospel of Judas, and you might find interesting, entertaining things. You might even find the Jesus you want to find. But I would encourage you to find the Jesus who really existed. And if you want to find the Jesus that really existed, there's really only one place to go. And it's the place that Christians have always gone. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Thank you very much. Let me just say, you can ask me a question on anything you want, but you have a better shot of getting an answer if it happens to be related to the Bible in some sense. Yeah, we'll start here.
Hi, is this on? Great. Well, that's good, because my question is on the Bible.
Very good.
I've heard a lot of skeptics, as I'm in conversations with them about the authority and the origination of the Bible, I've heard them say, how can we know that the originals were true if we only have copies and we don't actually have the original manuscripts?
Yeah, very good question. Let me repeat the question and sort of flesh it out for you that didn't hear it. So the question is, look, we say we have the Bible, which is a way of saying we have the words of the Bible. But how do we know we have the actual words of the Bible if we don't have the original, what are called the autographs, that the authors originally wrote? In other words, all we have are copies. And truthfully, all we have are copies of copies of copies, right? So how do we know that we have any reason to get back to the original sources? So this is a perennial question now because of the writings of Bart Ehrman, whose famous book, Misquoting Jesus, brought this to the lay-level audience. I can tell you this, is that when Ehrman wrote his book, lay Christians heard that and think, wow, how do we know that? And it almost got you almost got the impression that no one's asked this question before. And I can tell you this is a very old question, and it's a question scholars have explored for a long time. And here's the quick answer, is that a way we can be assured that the words of our Gospels or the New Testament in its totality are accurate, that the words that were originally written, we know that by how many manuscripts we have and how early they go. So if you're looking at text criticism, you want to have a lot of manuscripts, you can compare them to one another, and you want to go as early back to the sources as you can. And I can tell you the New Testament evidence here is overwhelmingly positive. You know, people ask me, how many copies of the New Testament do we have? And right now, the number stands probably well over 5,700 copies. Now, in your mind, you're like, well, that doesn't mean anything to me. Well, it might mean something to you if you knew what the average number of copies of books in the ancient world are that were written in the first century. And the average is probably somewhere between 10 and 20. If you look at other historical works, Tacitus's Roman History, even Josephus does well, and his book Antiquities have probably nearly 50 copies of that. Nothing touches the New Testament. What does that tell us? We can compare those manuscripts. We can look at them and see if they've changed. Not only that, but they're very early. We have them dating all the way back to the second century, whereas other manuscripts of other writings date well after the fact. So, for example, one of our earliest copies most of our earliest copies of Josephus are not until the 10th century. But we have copies of the New Testament all the way back to the second. So without doing a lecture on textual criticism, where'd my friend go here? There he is. We have extremely good reasons to trust our text. The final chapter in my book, The Heresy of Orthodoxy, covers this in a lot of detail. So if you want to go deeper, the last chapter in The Heresy of Orthodoxy. No one at that microphone? Back to you. All right.
Thank you for a great talk.
Yeah.
I read Bart Ehrman's most recent book. It's called How Jesus Became God.
Yep.
And I was kind of surprised to see he changed his whole tactic. Instead of pitting the canonical Gospels against the apocryphal Gospels, he's mostly just focusing on the canonical, but now he pits Matthew, Mark, and Luke against John.
Yep.
And I was almost stunned to read in his book that he claims that in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, nowhere in those books is Jesus presented as either A, divine, or B, the Son of God slash Messiah.
Yep.
And I went back just to make sure I wasn't insane, and I actually read Matthew, Mark, and Luke again, and multiple times he is directly called the Son of God, and it's either explicitly or strongly implicitly stated that he is indeed the Son of God and the Messiah.
Yep.
So I was wondering, he just states it like a blunt fact, and I was wondering, would he simply say those couple dozen parts where it does say he's divine or the Son of Man? Are those just like false insertions? It just seems odd that he can assert that when there's many parts sprinkled in those Gospels where it does say it.
Yep.
So
wow,
I
just made a good argument right there. but I'll put some flesh on that. So he's talking about Barnum's book, How Jesus Became God. Just as a side note, I reviewed that book at length. It's online. You can go to my website. For those of you interested in my website, which I try to write for more lay audience on my website, so if you've read my books and are frustrated, you might like my website better. So my website's name is Cannon Fodder, and by the way, that's a pun. So cannon, in the way I'm using it here, has one N, not two. Well, two, but not right next to each other, so Cannon Fodder. And on my website, I reviewed his book at length, so you can see my full-length review there. Notice what he said, what Ehrman does in that book. He never compares the divinity of Jesus in apocryphal Gospels with the ones in the canonical Gospels, and I'm going to tell you why. Here's why. Because when you look at the apocryphal Gospels, Jesus is remarkably divine. Now, you might get the impression that in the apocryphal Gospels that they missed it in terms of the divinity of Jesus. Well, they did miss many things about Jesus, but here's what's amazing about the apocryphal Gospels is they often got the divinity of Jesus right. In fact, in the apocryphal Gospels mind, the divinity of Jesus was a given. Of course he's divine. For most of the apocryphal Gospels, it was actually whether he was even human. Think about the Gospel of Peter I just told you about a minute ago, when Jesus is 60 feet tall and he's spirit Jesus, doesn't have a real body. It's because the Gospel of Peter has a view called Docetism, and Docetists believe that Jesus didn't have a real body. Why would you believe that? Because he's so divine, he could never really become a man. I want you to realize that in the early centuries of the church, people actually were so convinced of Jesus' divinity that the debate mostly centered on his humanity. Now, that's weird for us. Well, let me ask you this question. When's the last time you talked to your non-Christian friend and you tried to convince them Jesus was really human? They don't doubt that. You're like, of course he's human, but he's not God. You realize the ancient world's flipped. The reason Ehrman didn't want to talk about those apocryphal Gospels is because they actually show that it was pretty widespread in early Christianity that Jesus was divine. Now, the last part of your question is, what about Matthew, Mark, and Luke, right? Did the synoptics present Jesus as divine, or is it just John? You actually captured a lot of the problems with Ehrman's argument. Ehrman's argument, very one-sided, very sort of taking everything that could be looked at as divinity and knocking it off so it doesn't. But there's numerous things in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that point to the divinity of Jesus, and I don't even know where to begin because there's so many of them, but I'll give you an example. Jesus walking on the water, okay, which is a synoptic story that occurs all three synoptics, Matthew, Mark, Luke. What's interesting is that when Jesus was walking on the water and they were scared and they see him, his phrase there when he sees them is he says, ego me in the Greek, which means I am. Now, most English translations are going to translate that as I am he, or it's me, as if Jesus is walking in the water and says, guys, it's me, in case you're wondering. They knew it was, you know, they maybe thought he was a ghost, but that just doesn't fit the context. They use the phrase, I am there. Scholars think it's a reference to the divine name. Even critical scholars believe that. And for Jesus to say that while walking on the water, when the Old Testament texts abound with language of Yahweh as the one who controls the waters, and even there's Old Testament talks about him standing on the waters, it's very clear that Jesus is presented as divine. That's just one example. There's numerous places where this is done. I'll point you to the works of Simon Gathercole on this. Simon Gathercole has written numerous works on the synoptic portrayal of Jesus as divine, and you can explore his works more, and he would be contra Ehrman as well. Yes?
Growing up, I was back and forth between the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church, and a question I never really felt I got an answer to was the difference between the Catholic Bible and Protestant Bible. Why are there books that are in the Catholic Bible that aren't in the Protestant Bible? If there's a brief answer to that question...
There's no brief answers to any of these questions. Thank you for that. You get the award tonight for asking the question that I always get asked in discussions of canon. And I was thinking I might slip out of here tonight without having to answer it. So this question pertains to what's known as the Apocrypha. Let me do a little word definition here for you. You've heard me use the word called apocryphal. I talk about apocryphal Gospels. That word just means hidden. It's a word we use to refer to Gospels outside the Bible. But when it comes to the Roman Catholic books that are in their Old Testament, the term the Apocrypha is often used, okay? And this refers to books that are also known as intertestamental books, that are after our Old Testament, before the New Testament. Roman Catholics have adopted some of those books as part of their Old Testament, and it's books like 1st, 2nd Maccabees, Judas and Tobit, and so on. And so there's a long-standing debate about what to do with those books. Now, technically, it's an Old Testament canon issue. I'm a New Testament scholar, so I could just wave it off here. I'm not going to do that. I'll give you the simple answer for why Protestants believe those books are not in the Old Testament. And here's the answer. When we read our New Testaments, they cite from the Old Testament a ton. And when I say a ton, I mean a ton. Jesus always cited the Old Testament. Paul, I mean, good gracious. I mean, all he's doing is basically exegeting the Old Testament. I mean, we could list all the Old Testament citations and quotations from the New Testament, and they're in droves. And here's the stunning fact. Not once, not a single time, does Jesus, Paul, any of the apostles, any of the New Testament writers ever once cite a book from the Apocrypha as Scripture. Now, you just have to look at that and go, that's a stunning thing. Now, you could either explain that by saying they never got around to it, and it never really entered their mind, and it really was Scripture that is never quoted from it, or you realize there's something going on there. Every time they quote from the Old Testament, they're quoting from the books that we find in our, what we might call Protestant canon. I don't like using the term Protestant canon because that makes it sound like it's, like a party document. We would argue it's the canon that the Jews were using in Jesus' day. And here's what's interesting. Jesus would often cite from the Old Testament books in his conversations with the Pharisees, right? You know what's interesting about those? They debate everything. Have you ever noticed how much Jesus disagrees with the Pharisees and Sadducees? They disagree on everything. Even something as fundamental as the resurrection, they disagree on this. But you know what they never disagree on? Which books are Scripture? Ever. That's a stunning fact. That's why Protestants have those books in their canon and not the Apocrypha. Yes, thank you for using this microphone. We felt it was lonely over here. Needed someone to...
I was wondering, so Rudolf Bultmann talks a lot about the mythologizing that the early disciples might have done to Jesus, to the description of Jesus and his behavior. I was wondering if any of the textual research contradicts that or...
So this question, to give you a little background, it's about a guy by the name of Rudolf Bultmann, a very famous scholar. He wrote a very famous book called Demythologizing, paraphrase title, The New Testament. He argues that the stories of Jesus all filled with miracles or a taking of Jesus and putting him in the context of great Greco-Roman miracle workers and so on. And he's a very famous scholar for saying this. And so what Bultmann's idea is that if you're going to know what the real Jesus is like, you've got to peel back the husk of these mythological accretions and then find out what the real Jesus is underneath that husk. Now, that persuades a lot of people. I mean, if you want to believe in a non-miraculous, sort of, you know, good teacher-esque sort of Jesus with no real claim on your life, that's an attractive route. And you could just conclude that Jesus is just an itinerant philosopher and all these miracles are just added later. The problems with that, though, abound. And this is why Bultmann hasn't been really followed, at least in that category today. And that is, the context for understanding Jesus isn't Greco-Roman. The context for understanding Jesus is Jewish. And what you'll find about Bultmann and many of the form critics of his day is that they were working off, a broken paradigm, which is that you understand the way people view Jesus in the ancient world from a Greco-Roman context. The problem is Jesus was a Jew, came to Jews in Palestine, and you want to understand Jesus' behavior within a Jewish context. And when you do that, there's no reason to think he has to be demythologized. In fact, when you do that, you realize that Jesus is actually acting exactly what you expect the Messiah to do based on the Old Testament text. So there's no brief answers, but I gave it my best shot on that one. So, yes.
Hi. How important do you think it is to study the Bible in its original languages? And what's your favorite English version?
Yeah. That was sort of a tee-up to come to seminary right there. No, he's not an RTS student that I planted in the audience. So there's two mistakes that are made about the original languages, and there's really two extremes. One is to say they don't matter at all, and who cares? Okay, we disagree with that at RTS. I disagree with that personally as a scholar. The Bible is inspired in Greek and Hebrew, not in English or Spanish or whatever else we translate it into, and so it does matter that we read the original languages. And we train all our students at RTS to be very serious students of the original languages. They have to have 3 levels of Greek and 3 levels of Hebrew, and in addition to that, electives in both Greek and Hebrew. And so it's very much a part of our curriculum because we believe that the Bible is inspired in those languages and not in others. Moreover, we would also agree that not all English translations are as good as others. And the only way you're going to be able to adjudicate that is if you can actually read it in Greek and Hebrew. Okay, so those are all that extreme. But then there's another extreme. This is what I call the magic wand view of languages extreme, which is that if you don't know the languages, you really don't know how to read the Bible, and that when you do know the languages, it's like magic. You can wave Greek and Hebrew over the text, and suddenly you discover things no one's ever seen before. I disagree with that. In fact, as soon as students get to learn the languages, they're very dangerous at that stage because they think they know enough to go out and rediscover everything. And then when I hear them say, you know what I learned that I never saw before, I'm like, you're probably heading towards heresy by saying something like that. So very rarely do languages sort of miraculously give you something you never had. They help, and they're important. But here's what I want to reassure you with and everyone here. We have very good English translations. And you need to be really thankful to God for that. Because in the history of the world, most people didn't have the Bible in their language. And many people died and gave their lives to get the Bible put in English. If you know the history of the Reformation, you know that's what the case was with William Tyndale and John Wycliffe. And so we have very good English translations, and you can trust them. Doesn't mean they're all equally good, and there's a whole other conversation there. I'm surprised you didn't ask me which one I prefer. Don't ask me that. Oh, you did? I must have blocked that out. Subliminally wishing you hadn't asked. Man, what am I going to do with that? Okay, so I use the ESV. I did not get paid to say that. And if I did, it wouldn't be very much anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. I'm a student at Virginia Tech. I recently took a course, a New Testament course. Mm-hmm. And we talked a lot, or I guess we debated more on the authorship of Paul for a lot of the books in the New Testament.
Yeah.
The teacher, an older lady, biblical scholar, very intelligent, and she's a Christian too. I talked to her in office hours. But she is very certain that Paul did not write all of the books that it says that Paul wrote.
Yep.
So I just wanted to hear what you had to say about that. And also, if you do believe that Paul did not write all of the ones it says he wrote, what does that say about the validity of the Bible in general?
Great. Very good question. Thank you. So what she's asking about here is a belief among some modern scholars, and certainly in the critical scholarly world, many modern scholars hold that there are certain books in the New Testament that are forged. Okay. And again, I'm a bit surprised we haven't yet got that question. And they believe that there's a number of books forged, but one of the classic examples of this is they believe several of Paul's letters are forged. The standard examples are going to be Ephesians and Colossians, the pastoral letters, 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus, and so on. What do we make of this? I don't agree with that view, as you might anticipate. I think that's highly problematic on multiple levels. I think it's highly problematic just theologically speaking. If we believe these books are inspired by God, they're not going to deceive us in terms of who wrote them, so there's that. But I also think it's highly problematic historically speaking. Historically, it's doing stylistic comparisons within authors is extremely subjective and extremely difficult work, and it doesn't often lead to reliable results. And so I find it to be very subjective in terms of these arguments to try to prove that Paul didn't write these letters. We also know in the ancient world that when you wrote letters, you didn't always write them with your own hand. We have evidence that they use secretaries, and there's no reason to think that secretaries were strict dictation. They would often, you'd say something to them and they'd write it down, and they may change the words around. So stylistically, they can account for some of the differences. So I just don't find those arguments compelling. And by the way, I'm not the only one that doesn't find them compelling. There's a number of scholars out there that have written extensively on this subject and show that, no, we have good reasons to think that Paul did write these letters. And so I think you have to realize that it's a debatable point. Many scholars like myself don't find those arguments compelling at all. I heard a critical scholar once say that all scholars agree that Paul didn't write these letters. And you know what I reminded my students of on this quote is that, did you know this? You may not know this, that the top 10 largest seminaries in the United States are all evangelical seminaries. All of them. Now, that fact alone is interesting because all the mainline seminaries aren't in the top 10. They're a lot smaller. And my sort of humorous joke is, who must be teaching at all these schools? Because aren't those scholars? In other words, when someone says all scholars agree with me that Paul didn't write these letters, what they mean is all the scholars I prefer to talk about agree with me, or all the scholars in my little micro guild agree with me, or all the scholars I hang around with agree with me. But what I want to point out at a university setting is isn't a university setting designed to get all different views on the table. And I would suggest to you, and it would encourage you to realize that there's a whole pile of scholars that disagree with that assessment. Now, let's just, for the sake of argument, grant it for a moment. Okay? Let's say Paul didn't write those letters. Here's what's amazing, though, is that we do know he wrote Romans and Galatians, 1st, 2nd Corinthians, 1st Thessalonians, Philemon. There's so much theology in there that grounds the resurrection, the divinity of Jesus, justification by faith alone, that what's remarkable to me is that's still remarkably early testimony that the Christians believed all those things at the earliest phase, even if you grant their argument about the forgeries, which I don't grant. But even if you were to grant it, it still leaves us in a good position to know what early Christians believed and what Jesus was really like. Well, looks like I've scared everyone off from the other microphones. So my friend Sandy, come back up and close us out, my friend.